Boyd Gillespie discusses the role of phenotyping in surgical decision-making for patients with obstructive sleep apnea. Dr. Gillespie is professor and chair of the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. He was recorded on August 8, 2019, at the 6th Annual Best Evidence ENT, presented by the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Gillespie.
The OSA is certainly a public health issue. We know that from longitudinal studies where patients who are untreated end up having a higher mortality rate than people who are treated. And this is especially true for the severe sleep apnea group. We also have a gold standard therapy, which is CPAP, but there's really limitations to that. About two-thirds of people can be compliant with CPAP, but we have a fairly hard stop in about a third of patients. And this is a huge number of people who can't tolerate CPAP. And we've tried to improve CPAP, we've tried to improve AutoPAP, we've improved mask, but still there's about a third of patients who can't tolerate it. And we know it's efficacious therapy, but it has, you know, some problems in that a large segment of the population rejects it. So patients often seek alternative therapy. And this creates opportunities and dilemmas for the sleep surgeon. Some of the problems with sleep apnea is that, you know, we do have multi-level collapse of our airway. There's interaction between these anatomic sites. There's multiple factors that are involved, such as sleep stability, which you hear us use this term loop gain. I know it's kind of an abstract concept, but it's really one of your responsiveness of your brain and arousal centers to changes in your breathing patterns. There's passive airway collapsibility due to the stiffness and elasticity of the airway. There's active airway dilation. That's our neuromuscular integrity. There's soft tissue hypertrophy due to obesity, fat neck, large tongue, adenotonsillar hypertrophy. And then there's the craniofacial structure, the box of the airway. And we really need to look at these and individualize our treatment plan for our patients. So really the ultimate question is what surgical approach will maximize outcomes for a given OSA patient? And in this, we're really looking to phenotype. So if phenotype is the composite of an organism's observable characteristics or traits, it includes both their morphology and behavior, and it's determined by expression of the genetic code, interaction with external environmental influences. So often, you know, I'll see patients all the time who are worried about their genes, but genes are only part of the issue. I talk to patients all the time. I go, you know, your genes are like the books in a library, but it's really the environmental influences that determine which books are pulled and read, and that makes a lot of difference. So it's really the interaction of the two. And phenotype can be off a little bit. So I've been accused over the years of being George Stephanopoulos by a lot of people. And, you know, I think that's going to occur less as we get older because I'm graying and he has better grooming than I do, so better dye and all that sort of thing. But I've had patients tell me this and I've had other people tell me this in airports and things. So phenotype only gets you so far. And there are certain scientific hazards to phenotype because we may measure the wrong things. You know, 150 years ago, around the time that the Kohler company got going, there was a branch of medicine called phrenology. And they were right to note that a lot of behavioral characteristics, a lot of things with the way we act and behave are located in the brain, but they are wrong to note that it was mainly due to bumps on the scalp area. And I'm a big fan of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and this comes up in it before he goes to the Belgian Congo. His doctor examines his scalp to see if he has traits of madness. And then there's also potentially moral hazards for decision-making based on physical characteristics. And we have to be aware of that, especially when we talk about race. I mean, what is race? I mean, most people have, you know, now with our genetic testing, we find that most of us are actually a combination of different racial and ethnicities. So our nation has a history of treating people differently based on, you know, physical characteristics. And as physicians, we have to be mindful of that and make sure that what we're doing is appropriate. However, there has been some success in application of phenotype to sleep surgery. This paper is from 20 years ago, noted that our success rate with sleep surgery can really be based on some simple characteristics that we can measure, one being tongue position. So that's the Mallampati score, tonsil size, and body mass index. And based on these, we can really stage our patients. So large tonsils and normal tongue, you can have an 80% cure rate from soft palate surgery. Normal tonsils, normal tongue, it drops down to about 40% with soft palate surgery. And normal tonsils, large tongue, or large BMI, it can be as low as 8%. So it vastly differs based on some very simple, straightforward clinical characteristics that you can measure in the office. So we do have some phenotyping tools at our disposal. These are, include our history, physical examination, the sleep study itself, occasionally imaging, and possibly drug-induced sleep endoscopy, which we'll talk about in more detail. So on history, certainly insomnia is important because this can often lead to problems with certain devices that may change arousal thresholds in patients, respiratory instability, loop gain, nasal complaints. So often if patients have nasal complaints, addressing those complaints can make them a CPAP compliant patient. There are some things we know about physical examination that are less favorable for UPP, increasing BMIs, larger neck girth, you know, modified Mallampati scores showing larger tongues, jaw shape disturbances, high arch maxilla, retronathia misalignment, and then smaller tonsils. Then there's some things, factors we should look at in our PSG. I look at the supine to lateral ratio, because if it's mainly a supine issue, it's often due to tongue compression. If there's more REM-related AHI, it could be to neuromuscular collapsibility due to the loss of neuromuscular tone during REM sleep. And then certainly imaging can be helpful if you suspect jaw abnormalities. How can this affect our surgical decision-making? Well, if there's too much tissue, we're often thinking about some sort of tissue reductive surgery, whether that's UPP, partial glossectomy, weight loss, or bariatrics. And this too much tissue is often seen in people who are overweight. Our tongue is a third fat deposit. So as we get fatter, our tongues get larger. So this is called acquired macroglossia. And we do see this. And they have a normal jaw, but just a very large tongue. And you can see teeth indentations on the lateral tongue. Certainly adenotonsillar hypertrophy is important to note and can improve people drastically by removal of that lymphoid tissue. Is the box too small? Do they have a small craniofacial structure? And in this case, we really need to address these craniofacial issues such as MMA or maxillary distraction. So often these patients are normal weight. They have what's called relative macroglossia. So their tongue may look large, but ask yourself, is the tongue really large or is it due to being squeezed into a small craniofacial structure? They'll have a narrow mandibular arch, high arch palate, poor occlusion or retronathia, open or cross bite? Or is it due to laxity or poor neuromuscular tone? If so, you might be thinking some sort of tissue stiffening or repositioning procedure. Often these patients have normal BMI, normal tongue size, but that you may see clues on your sleep study like we discussed on supine sleep and REM sleep. So what's the role of drug-induced sleep endoscopy? Well, I think that this is debatable. We routinely do awake supine endoscopy as part of our evaluation, largely because it's easy to perform. We have scopes in our office. It's readily accessible for the office setting. We may identify inflammatory tissue that needs to be addressed in these patients, such as allergy, polyps, laryngopharyngeal reflux. And we may identify narrowing from tissue hypertrophy, you know, adenoid, palatine tonsils, pharyngeal wall squeeze, lingual tonsils, or tongue-based hypertrophy. The problem is awake endoscopy alone has been shown to have poor predictive power with regards to sleep surgery. Drug-induced sleep endoscopy was therefore added as an alternative. It is easy to perform, but it is more costly. It takes time. You have to do it in an OR. I do it in a Bronx suite in our hospital, but it does take time out of your schedule. It's generally poorly reimbursed, but the question is, does it help? It does allow us to visualize all three levels of the airway, the nasal, the oropharynx, and the hypopharynx, and we can correlate this with oximetry data and actually observe apneic events. It has been shown to be safe. It does allow us to see collapsible sites that we often don't see in awake endoscopy, such as tongue laxity or epiglottic collapse, especially. And it does allow us to characterize the collapse patterns during snoring and apneas. And often we're using something called the VOTE criteria. And the VOTE really stands for the different levels of the airway, the velopharynx, which is the soft palate, the oropharynx, tongue, and epiglottis. The degree of collapse, whether there's no collapse at that level, partial or complete, and to some degree, the pattern of collapse, whether it's AP, lateral, or concentric, which may have some bearing on success of different therapies. But the real question is whether this results in any better outcomes than awake endoscopy alone. So there's been some studies of DICE, and so what's the effect of drug-induced sleep endoscopy on sleep surgery decision-making? This was a recent systematic review of studies that looked specifically at whether DICE changed surgical decision-making. It was a meta-analysis of 8 study involving 535 patients comparing awake endoscopy to DICE. And they found that treatment decisions actually changed after DICE 50% of the time. Now, It doesn't tell us that they changed appropriately. It's just that you see things on DICE that make you change your surgical decision making. And this mainly focused on areas of how to treat the hypopharynx or larynx. So these are collapsible sites, especially the epiglottis, that you don't often see on awake endoscopy. But there was no evidence in this meta-analysis that these changes in surgical decisions actually resulted in better outcome. This was a preliminary study of the Inspire device done probably 10 years ago. This was a small subset analysis where when they were first doing the pilot studies with the Inspire device, a group in Antwerp noticed that patients with complete concentric collapse of the soft palate did worse with therapy than those without. And this was based on a very small study. So only 3 patients without palatal concentric collapse actually had a very good response to Inspire device, whereas 5 patients with complete concentric collapse did not respond to therapy. And based on this, Inspire said, we're going to make this a screening criteria for all our patients undergoing upper airway stimulation therapy. And this is really what we're looking for. And so patients with this, what we call AP palatal collapse, kind of an oblonged airway and lack of movement of the posterior and lateral walls, are favorable. And the reason is that this palatal collapse is very coupled with tongue mobility. So if you move the tongue forward, you're putting traction on the palatoglossal folds. You're pulling that palate forward. You're also relieving the mechanical pressure of tongue relaxation against the palate. Whereas in this case, you have a very round airway, a lot of movement of the posterior and lateral walls, not an oblong airway. You can grab the tongue and pull it out of the mouth during sleep endoscopy, and it will not change that shape. So that's a palate that's not coupled with tongue mobility, and that's why they don't respond to this therapy. This is some unpublished data I got from Inspire about, you know, all these patients who were in their STAR trial had Mueller and DICE, and I was interested to see how well they correlate, and they really don't correlate well at all. And that's in their patients who had complete concentric collapse on Mueller maneuver. A lot of them didn't really have complete collapse on Mueller maneuver, but were found to on DICE, whereas people with non-complete collapse, when we did Mueller maneuver, actually showed that they had complete collapse. So there's really no correlation between awake and sleep endoscopy. This is an ongoing study at my institution. Some of my pediatric otolaryngologists are working on this, is DICE influence intraoperative decision-making in children. At Le Bonheur Children's Hospital in Memphis, we see a lot of kids with severe sleep apnea. So these are kids with AHIs 20, 30, and we know that adenotonsillectomy alone, there'll be 40, 50% of these kids still with significant sleep apnea after adenotonsillectomy. So the question is whether DICE can actually be additive. So in our initial group, this is an ongoing study, we've had 29 pediatric patients with severe OSA, and DICE was performed at the time of their initial surgical intervention, and they had been consented pre-op for a variety of interventions based on the DICE finding in addition to TNA. And 57% of these kids show velopharyngeal collapse, 48% tongue-based collapse, and 21% supraglottic collapse. And overall, our results are pretty good. Pre-op mean was AHI of 22, post-op 7. Again, this is an ongoing study. So we are doing more surgery on these kids. What we really need is to do a randomized controlled study of TNA alone versus TNA plus to see if this actually has added benefit. So what is the effect of drug-induced sleep endoscopy on non-PAP or surgical outcomes? Well, there is some evidence that drug-induced sleep endoscopy does improve oral appliance outcomes. So this is a case control study of 20 patients who actually had DICE and were determined to be good candidates for oral appliance versus 20 patients who already had oral appliance and later got a sleep endoscopy. And they had no difference in baseline characteristics, but they found that there was significantly lower AHI in the group that was pre-selected for oral appliance than those who already got the oral appliance, and significantly more patients reaching rates of cure, 45% versus 15% in the groups that were pre-selected based on DICE. So DICE may actually be a very good tool for oral appliance selection. How about DICE and UPP outcomes? Well, this is a fairly large study by Dr. Yermchuk's group. She looked at 40 patients who underwent UPP and 64 who underwent DICE and UPP plus whatever other procedures the DICE suggested. And they found that there was actually no difference in AHI reduction in the UPP-only group, which reduced by an average of 20 AHI versus the UPP-DICE group, which was 21. But the significant thing was the DICE group actually had much more complications. So only 3% complications in the UPP only group versus 35% in the UPP DICE group. So DICE was actually driving us to do more surgery with inherently more complications with potentially maybe not any better outcomes for patients. And that was their conclusion. One of the problems with this paper, though, was that the UPP only group was a retrospective cohort, whereas the DICE group was a prospective cohort, which is very hard to compare because there may be confounders that aren't accounted for, especially when you're doing things like accounting for complications. So when you're looking retrospectively, you may not notice complications that were present that you get in a prospective group. This is a recent study done by Eric Kazarian looking at DICE. And we all actually sent Dr. Kazarian DICE examinations and data on our surgical patients. So it was a retrospective study of 275 patients who underwent preoperative DICE at 14 centers across the United States. And the DICE exams were read independently by him, by two examiners. You find here, though, that the agreement between their examiners on what they're actually seeing varies a lot. It's considered moderate inter-rater agreement, 40 to 55%, but it's still not perfect as a qualitative examination. 41% of the patients demonstrated an HI reduction of greater than 50% and overall HI of 15%. And they did find that collapse of the lateral wall of the oropharynx and complete tongue-based collapse on DICE was associated with poor surgical response. Here's another recent study from an international group that compared DICE to no DICE. And this was a retrospective study of surgical outcomes of 326 patients at seven international sites. 170 patients underwent DICE, and 156% of patients had no DICE. And the DICE group showed a 48% HI decrease compared to a 60% HI decrease for the no DICE group. So again, this calls into question whether DICE is actually doing anything that's helpful for outcomes. Again, this paper had a lot of problems in that they didn't control for which procedure differences were done at different study sites or the reasons why the different sites used DICE. So how about DICE and upper airway surgery outcomes? Well, as I mentioned earlier, based on that early data of just eight patients, they made DICE a screening criteria for upper airway stimulation. And the data for upper airway stimulation has actually been quite good. This is the STAR trial at 5 years showing sustained results from upper airway stimulation. So it's kind of hard to argue with the DICE screening criteria when you're actually having very good results. And this is the ADHERE trial, which is just a large database study, again, showing very good results from upper airway stimulation in pre-selected patients going from an average AHI of 30 down to 10 post-op. I have an ongoing study looking at my own sleep patients in preliminary stages at UT. And when I compare the results of my awake endoscopy vote score to my DICE group, I do see worse collapse on DICE. So the question is whether this is really meaningful or makes us do any meaningful surgery. When I compare the outcomes, though, in my group that had DICE to my non-DICE group, you find that the outcomes really aren't really any different between the two. So I think that's really the question, is whether we're doing anything that makes a meaningful difference long term. Is drug-induced sleep endoscopy reliable? Well, as I mentioned, it is a qualitative study, and we did want to look at this. This was a study that we did a few years ago where we actually took 64 video clips that had been used during the STAR trial for the upper airway stimulation, 10 of which were determined to have complete concentric collapse at the soft palate and 54 without complete circumferential collapse. We took these videos and blindly had five experts who were involved in the STAR trial read these and grade these. We were just asking one question. We weren't asking a vote scoring or anything. We just said, is there a circumferential collapse or not? The five people agreed 66% of the time. So again, it's not perfect. People see different things when they look at these videos. 12% of the time, four out of five of us agreed, but 22% of the time, there was significant disagreement on whether a complete circumferential collapse was present. So what do we know about DICE for non-PAP treatment selection? Well, it may improve our effectiveness of oral appliance fitting. It may not improve outcomes of soft tissue upper airway surgery over awake examination alone. It's hard to argue with the results of upper airway stimulation. So the good results actually validate the use of DICE as a screening eligibility for that. It may have a role in the initial surgery for severe pediatric OSA. But it still remains a subjective evaluation with expected disagreement in 20 to 25% of cases. And therefore, I think we need continued research on more precise methods of looking at airway collapsibility, whether that's sleep MRI or other things. In the last few moments, I do want to touch on a specific group that I'm interested in, is sleep disorder breathing in older adults, and whether this represents a different phenotype. And just based on my observation, I think there's kind of a bimodal curve for sleep apnea. I tend to see a lot of people present in their 30s, 20s and 30s, often when they've first been married and there's bed partner complaints. So there tends to be a spike for this group of people in younger adulthood. And then there's a group that does well for a long time, but starts developing symptoms in their 50s and 60s. So kind of a second spike that occurs. And are these groups of people similar? Well, I think there's some data that shows that they're different. These are just based on my own observations. If you look at people below 50 and those above 50, typically OSA prevalence is going to be more common as we get older. We know that from tissue laxity, but the severity may be less. Gender is mainly male in younger age groups, but it becomes more equal after menopause in women. BMI tends to be larger in this younger age group. That tends to be a driver of sleep apnea, where BMI may not be an issue in this older age group. Neck circumference, larger, smaller in this group. Tonsil size, larger, smaller in this group. So tissue-related factors being a driving factor in the younger group. OSA effects. So in this younger group, it's going to be a lot of cardiovascular morbidity and quality of life. This older group often is more a quality of life-driven related disorder. In this younger group, it's tissue hypertrophy, craniofacial disorders. It may be more neuromuscular and airway collapsibility in the older cohort. We do know that sleep apnea becomes much more prevalent as we age, and this is based on longitudinal studies with, if you look at people over 65, 24% have AHIs of greater than 40 if you were to do home sleep testing on them. So, I mean, that's a huge number of people in our population, especially as the baby boomers are reaching these age ranges. We do know that postmenopausal women have 3.5 times the risk of having moderate sleep apnea than premenopausal women. So women tend to catch up after menopause. There may be a hormonal factor there. And then we have loss of muscle tone associated with physiologic aging. So we may be more neuromuscularly predisposed to sleep apnea as we age. We do know that older people have more collapsible airways. And this is from, you can actually put negative pressure in the airway and the airway closes up at much less negative pressure in a 75-year-old than a 20-year-old. Here, only took a negative 1 to 2 centimeters of water pressure to collapse the airway, whereas it took closer to 10 to collapse the airway of a younger person. We also have less genioglossus response. So when you have obstruction of the airway, your genioglossus muscle should react and dilate the airway, but we have slower reaction times the older we get. So it's older age groups, slower reaction time in our muscles. And then there's other observations from large studies. So we see increased mortality only observed in patients less than 50 with AHI greater than 30. So this is really the group that has mortality problems, younger patients with severe sleep apnea. Mortality rates in older patients with sleep disorder breathing equal the mortality rates of those without sleep disorder breathing. Snoring, witness apneas, excessive daytime sleepiness are not associated with cardiovascular disease in patients greater than 65 years old. Sleep disorder breathing is not associated with blood pressure changes in adults greater than 60, unlike younger adults where the association is quite strong. However, this is the one caveat. There is an increased risk of stroke 2 times in older patients with sleep hypoxemia. So maybe we shouldn't be concerned much about AHI in older patients and more concerned about what their oxygen's doing, because we do know there's an increased risk of stroke. So what are the explanations for younger people with sleep disorder breathing? May have increased CO2 responsiveness and increased ventilatory control. So as their CO2 increases with obstruction, they have a vigorous response. So they have large changes in intrathoracic pressure, which causes large changes in heart rate, unstable breathing pattern, and catecholamine release. And these can directly lead to cardiovascular compromise. Whereas older people have predominance of airway collapsibility, neuromuscular decline, and less CO2 responsiveness, which actually causes less physiologic change and damage. So how do we treat sleep disorder breathing in older adults? Well, CPAP is still the treatment of choice. Older people can do quite well with CPAP. They have similar adherence rates to younger people. The best adherence is seen in patients with more severe disorders, and it can reduce snoring and reduce sleepiness. However, there's actually quite a bit of data that shows that it can improve mental agility and memory And that's an important thing to reinforce with your older patients. A lot of them don't want to try CPAP, but if you tell them this might improve your memory, your concentration, it'll reduce your need for napping, so improve your social interaction, a lot of patients are willing to give that a try. How about when they don't do well with CPAP? Well, I think we have to treat this group of patients differently. They may be more at risk for advanced or more aggressive surgical intervention. So I try to think of things that may be cost-effective, office-based or outpatient, minimally invasive, low pain and morbidity with rapid recovery and multi-level treatment. Because we want to match the severity of our intervention with the severity of the disease. And we shouldn't make a cure that's worse than the disease. And we should also address the outcomes of interest of a lot of older patients, which are snoring level, daytime sleepiness, and sleep quality. And fortunately, I think we have a grab bag of procedures that meet a lot of these characteristics. A lot of these procedures are not overly aggressive and can actually improve airway in this group of patients significantly. Now we have, you know, minimally invasive techniques for nasal collapsibility, such as Latera, soft palate collapsibility, which includes tissue stiffening procedures, which we'll talk about, oropharyngeal collapsibility. There are some things under trial that are very interesting that I'll mention. Hypopharyngeal collapsibility can also be addressed in less painful manners. None of these involve major removal of tissue. That's the common theme here. So morbidity's less and recovery's quicker. So how about soft tissue collapsibility? There's a lot of ways to stiffen the soft palate, whether it's radiofrequency, pillar implants, barbed suture techniques. There's a new technique, evaloplasty, that's come out, which is a resorbable barbed suture that can stiffen the soft palate. They're all kind of common. You know, if you look at all the data, I'm just trying to summarize it here for you, is similar. So no single technique predictably cures snoring. They all reduce snoring volume by 30 to 50% based on bed partner VAS. They all reduce daytime sleepiness by 30 to 50% based on Epworth. They all show a trend towards reduced effectiveness over time, best effects usually about 2 years. All cause minimum levels of pain and not requiring narcotics. All are safe with few complications, mainly being device extrusion or tissue ulceration. All can be used as first-line treatment option for snoring, upper airway resistance syndrome, or mild OSA. And all can be combined with multi-level procedures such as nasal surgery, basal tongue radiofrequency, oral appliance to further reduce snoring and improve treatment outcomes. So they're quite good. What they really differ is in stylistic difference. So the only one that could be multi-level would be radiofrequency. So if I have a patient I think has tongue-based and palatal problems and wants an office-based treatment, I'll use radiofrequency because I can treat both areas. Some are resorbable, such as barbed suture or the evaloplasty, which may have some benefits in patients who don't want a more permanent device in their body. Repeatable, radiofrequency is repeatable. Most of these are repeatable. So pillar implants may be not reusable. Actually, I reuse my radiofrequency tip. So when a patient purchases a radiofrequency tip, I actually clean it off, put it in a bag, and they take it home and bring it back in for a second treatment. You won't find this being FDA approved. Believe me, I've treated thousands of patients. I've never seen an infection from that. So shelf life may differ, and the cost to your office may differ a lot. So these are things that you have to consider. Something like a barbed suture only costs $30. New evaloplasty, $1,250. So you have to figure out what your market in your individual area will bear. This is my current paradigm. You know, I actually use cheap quill sutures, $30. You know, obviously you're going to add a procedural fee to that, which could economically be a few hundred dollars for the patient, and try out a tissue stiffening procedure to see if it actually has effect. It's almost more of a trial. So the quill suture is a resorbable suture, stays in the body for about 6 months. And I do a little, it's a double arm suture. So I'll throw a suture across the base of the uvula, then I'll throw one down to the edge of the soft palate, then throw one back up. And then on the other arm, do the same thing. It's completely buried and lifts and stiffens the palate and gives me an idea of whether palatal stiffening is going to work. And then once the patient's had this, they come back and they say, yeah, the result is good. We can consider something like pillar or evaloplasty down the road. You can still do this in about a minute. So it's easy to do. And you just drive the suture back through the hole that you came out of. And patients tolerate this real well. And it's quite an easy procedure. But as you pull on these barbed sutures, it compresses the tissue, but also lifts the palate to some degree. And then you give a little lift and you cut. So that's an easy kind of trial. So that'd be kind of my new thing to suggest to you. Consider doing something less expensive. See if it works. And if it works, move on to the more expensive sort of things potentially. So how about tongue stiffening? Well, I do use radio frequency for the tongue. This can be done in the office under local. You don't have to get all the way back in the vallecula. You're really treating that dorsum of the tongue because that's what comes into contact with the soft palate. And you can use some topical benzocaine and then 6 to 7 cc's of 1% lidocaine at the back of the tongue at the circumvallate papillae. And then I usually do 6 lesions in 2 locations. So I only do 2 stabs though. So I'll stab the device, go to the left, go to the midline, go to the right, and do the same thing in 2 different locations for a total of 6 lesions. You do have to repeat this 2 to 3 times to get the desired effect. You'll see you'll start to get some remodeling of the base of tongue with repeated treatment. There's new developments in soft tissue advancement. This is under trial right now, but I'm very excited about this. This is a new resorbable sling used to reposition the lateral walls of the throat in a very low morbidity, small incisional approach. So I really think this is the way of the future for potential UPP alternatives. Hypopharynx soft tissue advancement can also be done. You know, OSA is associated with low hyoid. Low hyoid elongates the upper airway, creating a longer collapsible segment. It positions the tongue more posteriorly. It's a little more common in males. But hyomandibular suspension can prevent epiglottic prolapse by placing tension on this hyoepiglottic ligament. It actually pulls the lateral pharyngeal wall by placing tension on the stylohyoid muscles, and it does provide modest lift of the tongue base. There has been 2 systems available, AirLift from Siesta and AirVance from Medtronic. Medtronic's recently decided that they're going to forego the AirVance, so the AirLift's really our option. Now, I'm hoping somebody will purchase AirVance because it's a very good technique. One thing I like to do during sleep endoscopy when I see epiglottic collapse, I actually pull on the hyoid and I'll lift the hyoid forward. When I hold the hyoid forward, my epiglottis is repositioned, the airway is open. And then I'll release the hyoid and the epiglottis will flop back to what it's doing during sleep. So that's a nice little test you can do during sleep endoscopy to see if hyoid suspension would be helpful. So we did a study of standalone hyoid suspension in patients we felt had this epiglottic level collapse to see what it would do. And actually, it as a standalone therapy is pretty good. 47% of patients had a greater than 50% reduction in AHI and overall AHI less than 20. And 42% of patients actually had a final HI less than 10. And that's with just a hyoid suspension alone and properly selected patients. And it's actually a quick recovery and it's not a painful procedure. Their main complaint is they get some submental edema and I actually have them massage that, you know, and use some triamcinolone cream and they get rid of that edema. It's actually a very good code as well. So it's among one of our better coded procedures for sleep surgery 21685. And I really haven't run into any problems with payers with that code. Oropharyngeal and hypopharyngeal tissue advancement can also occur with oral appliance. So oral appliance is an important part of our armamentarium, but in older patients, you have to make sure they have adequate dentition. My dental sleep medicine specialist actually does bite molds that we're actually going to try some different offsets of their bite and different advancements to see which one fits the best so that we can custom. During drug-induced sleep endoscopy, you can do a palatal stiffening procedure such as pillars, epiglottoplasty, radio frequency, depending on whatever your choice is. And then we select the best appliance. And you can pretty much guarantee that if the patient wears it, they're going to have an open airway. Certainly neuromuscular is important. Inspire, we've talked about that. The Inspire also works for the hypopharynx. If you include that muscle branch that goes to we're trying to get the neural branches to the genioglossus muscle, but there's also this little branch that goes to the geniohyoid. And we're starting to include that because that actually gives us epiglottic lift, pulls that epiglottis, and then a whole hypopharynx forward by getting that geniohyoid muscle activation. And there's some evidence that upper airway stimulation actually works better in older patients. This is a recent study, a comparison of younger and older patients who underwent upper airway stimulation therapy, quite a few number of patients. And the older adults, greater than 65, had a 30% better HI response and greater normalization of Epworth scores and higher nightly use rates than younger patients. So And it's probably because it's addressing the underlying physiology better, the neuromuscular collapse. So in conclusion, sleep surgery outcomes will improve with better patient phenotyping. Older patients with OSA may have unique phenotypes characterized with increased tissue collapsibility and neuromuscular decline. And there's newer surgical techniques that can address these issues in older patients with lower morbidity. And it's important to keep an eye on the outcomes that matter to these patients, which go beyond AHI to include snoring, sleepiness, function, memory, and concentration. So don't delay. Get your treatment if you need it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gillespie. We'd also like to thank the Medical College of Wisconsin for its cooperation in the publication of this lecture. For more information about upcoming CME conferences presented by the Medical College of Wisconsin, visit mcw.edu.